This is Live from the Table, the official podcast of the world-famous comedy seller, coming at you on Sirius XM 99 Raw Comedy and wherever you get your podcasts. We're also available on YouTube. If you want a visual experience, you get to see our pretty faces, some more pretty than others. This is Dan Natterman, co-host, comedy seller, regular, maybe not as regular as I would prefer, but that's not my call. I'm here with Noam Dorman, owner of the Comedy Cellar.
Present.
And the new Comedy Cellar location on 6th Avenue and West 3rd Street is scheduled to be open sometime in 2025.
Let's hope so.
But meanwhile, Noam is making a killing selling ads to Kylie Jenner.
Is that who's in the...
Kylie, or I don't know. There's advertising in the building, Noam is making money.
Yes.
obviously, you know, I would assume he would make more running the comedy club.
It defrays costs, okay? It costs money to carry an empty piece of real estate in New York City.
Okay.
Are you Jewish or not?
Well, no, that's great, though, but not everybody can defray costs.
Yes, okay, go ahead.
So you have that option.
Yes.
And you have, you know, so anyway.
It's like a write-off. What do you think? It's a write-off? You don't have to pay for it because it's a write-off? But go ahead.
That is what I
You
thought.
Don't know what a write-off is.
I know what it is.
What's a write-off?
A write-off is a tax deduction.
A write-off is when the government pays for whatever you want.
Anyway, we have a guest coming in a bit. When's he coming? At 5:30?
Can I tell you what I did last night?
Yeah,
I was a guest. First of all, the war in Israel is just killing me. I tell you, I can't take the pressure. This fucking accusation of genocide. I'm second to none in terms of being able to be charitable and calm around people I disagree with. And actually,
yeah, I mean, even Aaron Monte can't get under your skin, so I don't know who can.
And actually, mean it. Like I actually...
You're not like that with me.
If Aaron Mate came in today for a drink, mm-hmm. I swear to God, I'd be, oh, good, Aaron's here. Like, I'd argue with him. And I've no... Because to me, Aaron... First of all, he's a nice guy. But second of all...
No!
All right, stop. But second of all, there's nothing phony about how he presents himself. He's like, this is what I believe... And I'm not backing down, and I'll be happy to tell you how I believe, and you know, and I know where he stands, and actually he'll even play by the rules in the sense that if we have a disagreement, we send each other an article. That's why he'll say, "Oh yeah, you're right," but then he'll just find something else to back up his point. But he won't. Whatever. I really don't have anything bad to say about Aaron Mate. I really don't. What drives me up a wall are the people who claim to be on the other side, but then are cowards and bend to peer pressure and start saying things to meet the people who hate the Jews halfway or go out of their way to make all these disclaimers. Not that disclaimers shouldn't be made, but so much so that it basically just guts their point.
For instance...
I don't want to use names, but
why? Name names.
Stop.
What if I name a name?
No. And
okay. And you blink.
So for instance, so this charge of genocide. Now, I mean, I don't want to get into it. We'll do another episode about it. But it's like, to me, I use the analogy, it's like acid rain on the Jewish psyche, and it's corroding the psychology of my children. And there's nothing we can do about it. What they're doing is that they are canceling the Holocaust in a way, in the sense that if they had their way, the history of the 20th century would be talking about, oh, what was the genocides in the 20th century? Oh, well, the Nazis did it to the Jews, and the Hutus did it to the Tutsis and the Pol Pot, and then the Jews did it to the Palestinians. So, you know, like algebra, you have... One X on this side, one on the next side. You put a line through both of them. It all evens out. And in some sick way, this relieves the pressure that the Holocaust is just puts on the world. In the same way that like Tucker Carlson was always looking to find out that the black people in South Africa were taking the property or killing people. You know, he's desperate to find that the black people in South Africa are turning the tables on the white people, because in some way, I believe, this relieves the pressure of the terrible thing that the white people did. Well, you see, the black people did something terrible too. I'm happy that's off the list, right?
By the way, I know Noam is very serious about this topic because when he mentioned algebra, he didn't say, "I know, Perry, you didn't take algebra." But that's something he would normally say.
So,
but if you were in a more lighthearted mood.
So now, you know, I was thinking, you know, again, we had to do a whole episode about it. But in the old days, if, for instance, Benny Morris chronicled a number of massacres, you know, the Jews in 48 during the war, there were some massacres of towns where they killed, I don't know, hundreds, maybe people, thousands. What were they called? They were called massacres. They weren't called genocide because nobody thought there was genocide. We know what genocide is. A genocide is a plan to eradicate a people. For instance, the Hutus, do you know what the Hutus did? They went on the radio. They urged they urged all their citizens to, you know, to end the Tutsi problem. In 100 days, they killed, I think, something like 700,000 people with machetes, blunt objects, rocks. Can you imagine the Ridley Scott epic of that battle? Or whatever, not battle, that atrocity, 700,000 people in 3 months with machetes. Israel has the firepower, I mean, I don't know, but to eliminate 1 million people, I'm just presuming in days. Well, I mean, certainly they have a nuclear bomb, but short of that, I mean, they could just go, like, the, you know, there's no pushback, really, if Israel decided they wanted to commit a genocide. And yet they dropped 45,000 bombs and there's 33,000 dead, including fighters. If we just, you know, let's just assume the numbers, fewer than one person per bomb. That's their genocide, right? So, but it's so satisfying for people to call it genocide and concentration camp and every word that you can take from the Jewish history and neutralize it.
Well, not to mention
suck all the energy out of it by making it mundane, quotidian, as Abigail Schreier used.
I would add, and I don't know if this is a coincidence, but the word Nakba is Arabic for disaster, and the word Shoah,
catastrophe, I think.
Catastrophe. Well, those are synonyms, and the word Shoah is which is the word that is used in Israel to denote the Holocaust. The word Shoah, and Shoah means in Hebrew disaster or catastrophe. Is that a coincidence, or is that another example of?
I think that may be coincidence.
All right, I throw it out there.
I don't know. But again, it doesn't bother me when the Aaron Mate does it. It doesn't bother me when the Arabs do it because, though I think they're wrong, that, you know, they're no more slaves to their upbringing than Hasidic Jews are. Or, I mean, these are not, you know, any hyper-theological, hyper-ideological people that's raised from birth with a particular kind of, you know, marination of thought. I can't excuse it when they, what they're doing, but I don't imagine that if I were in their shoes, I think I'd be different, as if I would imagine myself if I was born in the Deep South. Oh, I would have known not to have slaves. You know, I know that that's not true. That's an arrogant thing to say. But the everyday liberal, secular Jews that I know who just blow like the wind, depending on what the current view in the Democratic Party is about what Israel is doing or what isn't doing. They make me fucking sick. And they are the problem. And, you know, I've been feeling this way for years already, because back when the Jews weren't allowed to march in the Women's March and the Jews weren't allowed here, when I used to argue with everybody, and I would argue, and I'd be writing emails to people, say, well, what are you talking about Trump for? Like, what are you worried about Trump? Like, people, and Trump said the Jews need to pay more attention to Israel, calling upon a classic anti-Semitic trope of dual loyalty. Like, this is such nonsense. And I remember saying at the time, with enemies like Trump, we don't need friends. And this is not an endorsement of Trump. It was just a saying, like, no, Trump is not our enemy. Trump may be a disaster for the country, but Trump is not the guy who was breathing fire to the anti-Semitism. It was always the left. It was intersectionality. And now there's not a college campus in the country where Jews are hanging their heads high, holding their heads high. I got an email from a girl, a customer in the Olive Tree. She's in Columbia Journalism School. She's a young girl, young woman. And she told me that her friends, and she's not religious, but she heard her friends whispering that they want to invite somebody to Shabbat dinner. And they were afraid to have it overheard because it was, you know, provocative to be heard talking about Shabbat dinner. This is, you can make me cry. This is a fucking tragedy.
This is a tragedy. There's no doubt.
And so from this, I hear an echo now.
Yeah, we got
from
this, the guest is
in. From this, we want to introduce into this already very dangerous dynamic the notion of genocide. Now, every Jew either is a Nazi sympathizer or he has to publicly disavow himself from these people. All right, whatever. So this is how I'm feeling.
No. Not whatever. To be continued.
Yeah. So I'm very upset about it. So here.
We have with us.
Hello, sir. Can you see us? Hey.
Like, can you hear me?
Yeah.
I got you. We have with us.
Turn him up, Max.
Via the miracle of teleconferencing, attorney Edward Obayashi, deputy sheriff and legal advisor for the Plumas County Sheriff's Office and a licensed attorney in the state of California. His law office specializes in providing law enforcement legal services to California law enforcement agencies. And he also serves as a legal advisor and legal consultant to numerous law enforcement agencies. Welcome, Ed Obayashi, via teleconferencing to our podcast.
Thank you. And just a correction, my fault. It's just been updated, but I am now with the Modoc County Sheriff's Office here in California. So, but thank you for that.
So we're very happy to have you. I first, your name first came across my radar when I was doing some research about this whole Derek Chauvin thing. And I want to talk to you about that because you're an expert on that stuff and on the Minnesota policies of vis-a-vis neck restraints and how that culture might have led to what happened with Derek Chauvin. But since then, you sent us some interesting other stories that you're involved in that maybe you wanted to talk about. And maybe we'll start with that because one of them has actually touched a nerve with me because it's something that's close to my heart with a personal experience that I'll tell you about. Maybe I'll start by playing that news report that you sent me, the Channel 10 news report. Is that okay?
Sure,
yeah.
Of course.
So play that, Max, to introduce the subject. And then Mr. Obayashi can tell us about it. Go ahead.
Disturbing new video showing the moments leading up to a man's death in Rio Linda. ABC 10's Lou Clary explains why the family is now considering taking legal action.
Chris, the family of Christopher Gilmore said that he was suicidal, not out to hurt anyone else. They called 911 to get him help, and minutes later, he was dead, shot several times by a sheriff's deputy. A warning, this video is difficult to watch.
Saturday, March 23rd. Sacramento Sheriff's deputies responding to an 8:15 a.m. call for a suicidal man who'd been cutting himself in the bathroom of his Rio Linda home. They call him outside. Christopher Gilmore emerges naked and bleeding, stumbling through a barrage of less lethal rounds before a deputy opens fire with his service weapon. All of this happening right in front of his sister, Bobby Gilmore, who called 911 in the first place and now regrets that she did.
I called the ambulance, not the car.
All right, that's good, Max.
Just imagine how terrible it is to say.
That's good, Max. So let me just describe to the people who are listening and not watching on YouTube that what you see is a driveway and a naked, portly, kind of a chubby guy who looks almost from his gait to be mentally ill, right? Something not about right about, and he's obviously not having any concealed weapons. And he walks out, kind of stumbling out, and they just shoot him.
Would he have a knife on him or something?
No, I don't. Well, I don't. We'll ask the guest. I don't think so. And they say
he had a kind of a razor type device of some sort.
Oh, because he was cutting himself like.
Yes.
Okay. So, well, tell us now, what's your, what do you want us to know about that? And what should we learn from that?
Well, I don't know if you're going to play the rest of the, my interview.
No, I figured you would tell us live. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
So the issue of whether or not the shooting was justified is a separate issue from the one I was, that caused a certain amount of, say, controversy, mm-hmm. that story caused. What I mentioned was that, the bigger, more important issue here is whether or not law enforcement should respond to these types of situations. In other words, responding to a suicidal subject. You might have seen from the LA Times article that I sent to supplement that a story about maybe 3 years ago, 4 years ago, that was a front page article on the Los Angeles Times about my department being the first department in California to adopt a formal policy, which I created for police non-response to these types of situations, given certain circumstances. And the reason for that one is for years and years, we have responded to these calls. We want to do the right thing. That's why I became a cop. I know it sounds altruistic, but that really is the motivation. Mm-hmm. At least when I started being a cop almost 25 years ago, things have changed significantly since then. But
how have things changed?
In terms of, what is the motivation these days now for the younger generation for becoming cops? Is it really altruistic, or is it another reason? Is it money? We just don't have any.
Is it similar to the reason people enlist in the Army now is because it's a good paycheck rather than at a patriotic duty?
Yeah. Well, when you've got departments offering $100,000 bonuses, mm-hmm. to sign up, along with six-figure incomes annually just to start out, you start wondering, what the motivation is. Of course, we try to ascertain that through the background process. But again, look at what's happening across the United States in terms of the quality of some of the officers. That, and you may be aware, that was one of the, in my opinion, one of the underlying problems with the Tyre Nichols murder, where those officers were, according to the media sources, were completely unqualified to be in those law enforcement positions.
Which one was that? Was that where they kicked the guy in the head?
That was one where they basically a number of cops stood this individual up and just were taking free shots at him.
Yeah. What state was that in?
That was I believe Tennessee.
Yeah,
I believe.
Yes. And in the end, one guy kicked him in the head, I think, right? Or something like that.
They were hitting him with batons, this, yeah. Everything. I mean, it was just horrific.
It was undercovered, in my opinion, because that was the worst one we'd seen in terms of the clear intention that the cops had of wanting to do something terrible, in my opinion, to the person they had in their custody.
In your opinion, I agree with it. Yeah. That's what I told the press. I said, I lived through the Rodney King, mm-hmm. Beating. I was in LA at LAPD headquarters. When the officers were acquitted and then the riots took place, but that changed. That was it was a quantum shift in how we all perceived use of force in the United States. And the reason I bring this up is because, in my opinion, as I told the press, Tyre Nichols was much worse than Rodney King, because mm-hmm. I can understand the circumstances of the Rodney King beating. In other words, all the background circumstances, et cetera. But the Tyre Nichols issue, that was just pure sadistic.
Yep.
You mentioned the six-figure incomes and signing bonuses. Isn't sort of the conventional wisdom that you pay more, you get better quality, you attract better people?
Yes, no, that's true, very much so. But the problem is, in today's atmosphere, we're having a hard time recruiting good candidates in spite of those significantly high salaries that are being offered. So what happens, unfortunately, is that since we can't attract the candidates that we normally, maybe in the past, that we were able to hire and attract, we're having to deal with a lesser qualified pool of applicants. They may be as qualified or what we're looking for, but the pool that we're dealing with is much, much smaller.
We're having to reach out to
in my experience, I've been through situations where departments are hiring marginal candidates.
So we put you on a detour. I want to get back to the mental health issue, sure. But just one last question about this quickly. Is this a result of the total demoralization of police forces around the country, starting with Ferguson and all the defund the police stuff? Are people just who would want to be a policeman now? You're just the object of ridicule. Is that the reason, or am I reading too much into it?
No, you're correct. That is one of the primary reasons and is often cited in surveys. Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right, get back to the mental health thing, if you don't mind.
Yeah. Yeah. So and I've been on these types of calls countless times. They're, as you can appreciate, that they are routine calls everywhere in the United States. My son is in the bathroom. He's threatening to kill himself. He's got a knife. He won't come out. And so we've always regularly responded ever since I've been a cop and before that. But over the years, what we have seen is that with the effects of, and I'm not a trained psychologist, and this is only from observations, is that we see more and more of these troubled individuals, more and more in today's society. I've seen it grow significantly over my career as a cop. What is it? Drug use, alcoholism, who knows? But it's just, it's prevalent throughout society. The issue of suicide is well publicized. A lot of efforts to address it. There have been a lot of criticisms about whether or not these programs and responses are effective. But here's the thing. We as officers are not equipped to deal with these types of subjects. I'm talking about the subject who is suicidal, but is only a threat to himself or herself and not others, and just wants to end it all.
Go ahead, finish. If you finish your thought, I'm sorry. Sure.
And what happens is, unfortunately, in a lot of these instances, and it's not just California, obviously, we respond and bad things happen. Mm-hmm. And the courts over the years have recognized that the solution, in other words, the police solution is often worse than the problem. And it is. And in this particular incident, the one that you showed the news clip from, is a perfect example. It's the ideal example. I hate to use that term in this context, within this backdrop. But the individual, the family called and said the individual was suicidal, but was only a threat to himself. He was in the bathroom, and the family was outside the residence. So he wasn't threatening anybody, and no one was in danger. Plus, he was schizophrenic, according to the family. Excuse me. And he had actually committed a felony assault on a police officer, I believe, a couple of weeks prior. And he was out of jail. And most importantly, that the information also given to the cops, according to what I was advised, is that the individual said, I am going to commit suicide by cop. So you have all those indicators and warnings to the cops that this is going to end in a bad way. Yet they responded. And experience and data have shown that if we don't respond to these situations under these types of circumstances, they work themselves out. They resolve themselves much more often than not.
Well, so a few things. First of all, just as to the shooting, it seems very hard for me to understand why they shot him, because they could just stay out of his way. I mean, I don't know enough about it, but you know, I just can't believe that it didn't look like they had to kill.
It looked
that
like
guy.
Murder to me.
It looked like, but that's, you know, just stay out of his way.
No, and I understand that it looks bad. They all look bad. Yeah. In this case, there's going to be a lot of criticism of the officers, and there usually is, obviously, when there's any type of use of force. But yeah, there are going to be, I can assure you, there are questions, and there's going to be, the investigation is going to delve into why did you feel that this individual was an immediate threat to your safety?
Yeah.
The body cam videos will be very revealing. We don't have those yet.
Yeah.
But about 3 years ago, I was brought in to advise the California Department of Justice to how to investigate these shootings of individuals who are not armed with a firearm. But part of that training also to law enforcement throughout California, which I've done for years and continue to do so, is what is the what better tactics can we use? Yeah. In response to these situations.
So, was there a taser used initially?
No, they deployed a beanbag.
Okay.
And multiple beanbag rounds hit the individual, but as is not uncommon against individuals who are schizophrenic or under the influence of drugs, often tasers and beanbags are really ineffective.
So my second thought is that it seems to me that if there's a report where somebody has a weapon, even if they claim it's suicidal, sooner or later, somebody with the weapon is going to kill somebody who tried to stop them from committing suicide or something like that. It seems difficult for the cops not to respond. But let me tell you my personal story and why I have this tremendous sympathy for this. I had a friend, I must have told this story years ago, a couple years ago when it happened. I have a friend who's one of my really, really few, really intimate, close friends in my life. And he developed manic depressive symptoms well into our friendship. And when he's having a manic episode, he was totally crazy. No less crazy than somebody you would describe as paranoid schizophrenic, you know, just like totally out of his mind, hearing voices, crazy. He one time held a bottle over my head and threatened to kill me, which he never actually hurt anybody, but he looked like he could hurt somebody. So he was at his mother's house. His mother's elderly, and he was having an episode, and he was getting physical. Didn't hurt anybody, but they were scared of him. So they called the cops, and the cops came. And the cops began to arrest him. And the mother and the sister pleaded with the cops to take him to Bellevue, the mental hospital. They said, don't put him in jail. It's terrible for him. Take him to the mental. Look up his record. You'll see he's a mental patient. He's not on his medication. Take him to. And the cops didn't want to hear it. They brought him in front of the judge. What the judge did was give an order of protection that nobody asked for, so that now he couldn't go home, but didn't take him to the mental hospital. He walked the streets and then jumped off the 59th Street Bridge, I forget which bridge, and killed himself. That's it, done. Exactly a cousin of what it is that you're describing, where this time the cops didn't kill him, but a combination of a lack of training and a lack of concern, institutional lack of concern, took somebody who was a beloved person who was having an episode. His episodes were few and far between, and now he's dead. You know, so this is one of the most difficult things I've experience. So that's why the issue that you're describing means a lot to me. If maybe I can't see it actually working in this particular scenario that you describe, I think you're very much on the right side of wanting. I'm sure there's many, many people that could be helped with this.
Yes. And I will tell you this. I know, because I have not encountered any cases, because I keep being informed of these types of incidents throughout California. And when I'm, I can pretty much say with 100% confidence that anytime officers in California encounter an individual such as the one that got shot and your friend, if we're able to take them into custody, they are automatically, by law, we are taking them to the mental health facility for observation. And that is the protocol. Mm-hmm. And to a T, I don't know of any situations where officers in California would, as you describe it, take an individual and just drop them off at a bus station somewhere and say, have a nice day.
Yep.
We're certainly not going to take him in front of a judge. The judge would have a few words with the chief if we did that.
Well, I actually convened lawyers and wanted actually to sue the city on his behalf with his family, because exactly the kind of protocols that you're describing, I think, are similar to what goes on in New York. But I'm sure this will be no surprise to you. When I spoke to the lawyers who were expert in this, they told me that, you know, it's very difficult to fight City Hall, and you can spend hundreds of thousands of dollars with a meager chance of success. And of course, it's not going to bring him back. So you do it because you want to bring attention to it, to do something good for society. But at some point, his family, you know, just decided it was more than they wanted to go through. I think also part of it is because then you have to relive the incident every day for the next 5 years that you're involved in this lawsuit. And that's a tremendous psychological toll, you know?
No, I agree. You know, I can only speak for California, but I can tell you California has a, if I can use this term, a very robust police liability, legal industry.
Yeah. All right. Well, the other incident that you sent was this very disturbing headline. Los Angeles Times: does racism make you, quote, too stupid to be a cop? A California law said yes. And what it describes here, I'll just read. A few weeks ago, the Contra Costa County District Attorney released the result of an investigation that found up to 40% of police officers in Antioch, a Bay Area enclave with a majority of non-white residents, were linked to a racist text message chain. Calling black people monkeys and gorillas wasn't the worst of it. There's a link to it. I looked at the actual text messages. There's memes comparing black people to apes. There's N-word jokes. I mean, if you can, we were talking before you came on about anti-Semitism. If you could imagine being Jewish and knowing that you were being policed by policemen who were trading these kind of memes about Jewish people, it boggles the mind that this could go on in America. So not in Mississippi, right? Do you want to talk about that? What's your take on that?
And did you see my comment?
No, I didn't. I didn't.
That headline regarding stupid, where that came from?
No, go ahead. Go ahead and tell us. I must have missed that. Go ahead.
No, I told them that if you do this, you're too stupid to be a cop. And I mean that. excuse me, further upset, but that's...
If you need to get some water or something... need to get some water or something, don't mind. You're not going to hold us up. We can just cut out the little space or something if it would help you.
No, I'm okay.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah. another department. And again, I don't have my PowerPoint isn't big enough. I don't have enough gigabytes to document all these types of social media stupid acts by cops. Just so you know, like I say, one of my slides covers another department where, and you were talking about Jewish, you know, anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. I've got cops texting each other about Auschwitz jokes. This is on department time.
Funny ones?
Or in private. Okay, what's concerning here, really, this is, in my opinion, it's a much worse problem. I don't really consider use of force it is a problem, but it really is, it's an everyday occurrence. I can understand, especially in my position, when cops have to use force. Mm-hmm. The biggest difference between use of force and social media misconduct by cops is the fact that there is no justification for this type of activity. There just isn't. There, you know, it's not like your life is in danger, you're trying to protect someone. There's just no reason for it.
Yeah.
And in the, you know, for years and years and years, use of force was my primary area of concern, study, and investigation for all many departments in California. And it still is, obviously. But over the past several years, social misconduct by police officers, in my opinion, has become much more of a problem, and it's a much more of a serious danger to society than any other perception of police other types of police misconduct. I never thought I would see it or understand it, or I mean, even encounter it in my life, but officers across the country have become radicalized. And to me, that's the scariest situation.
Radicalized how? Because
becoming involved with white supremacist groups. Perfect example, like the ones you just mentioned. The texts, associating themselves with certain fringe radical groups, et cetera. Think about it. How stupid do you have to be to memorialize forever these types of comments, which are going to get out in the public? You're a cop. I mean, really? Are you that stupid? So, I mean, it's come to that point for me in my professional opinion. I don't care what it is, why you did it. It doesn't matter. You do this, you're too stupid to wear that uniform.
Yeah, I what you're describing is horrible.
It's so widespread that, yeah. Like I said, these are not isolated incidents. I have incidents where chiefs, the heads of department, have participated in this type of misconduct. I mean, it is really scary. In response to that, I have developed, per request, law enforcement, I have the only state certified law enforcement training class on social media misconduct, the do's and don'ts and how to address it.
Now, the only thing that I don't want to argue because I don't know anything about it, but when I hear this kind of racist back and forth, as disgusting as I find it, I don't assume these people are white supremacists in terms of, you know, ready to start attending meetings and pursue a political agenda of white people. What I see is run-of-the-mill, vulgar bigotry, which I assume has always been there, but the technology didn't allow for it to come out, as you say, memorialized, as it has for so many people, including teenagers say stupid things. I mean, all of society is learning to live with the fact that digital records are forever. So we're learning about each other. And I would think that we're learning about, you know, how people have always interacted. But if you have evidence that these people are also, you know, white supremacists in terms of pursuing their agenda, that's a whole nother level of horrifying to me. In other words, let me finish.
I'm sorry to tell you.
Wait, hold on.
Evidence.
So I want you to give the evidence in 1 second. So to make the analogy, like if I know that a bunch of Jews are anti-Semites, I don't really assume that if my business calls one of these cops that they're going to take the side of the against me, because people are complex that way. They can hate the Jews but still defend the Jewish citizen in some way. But if they're Nazis, then it's a whole nother level of animus. Then they are actually motivated politically with an agenda against the Jews. So some people might rolling their eyes at me even trying to split those hairs, but I think there are distinctions there. But you're about to tell us why these are actually members of a political organization. So go ahead.
I do these investigations across California, into social media misconduct allegations. I hear about them. Chiefs will call me, say, "Ed, this is what my cop did, etc." They're unfortunately a lot of these cops, and I don't have numbers, but too many of them are directly associated with hate groups. The Anti-Defamation League and the Southern Poverty Law Center have identified these groups, have identified officers.
The Southern Poverty Law Center is has a lot of knocks on their record in terms of being, you know, a fair arbiter. But that doesn't mean that they're not right here. But I just want to point that out.
I take that all into account. But yeah. those two organizations. Yeah. Are referred to and listed as resources in the California Post website for officers, for chiefs and managers to use as a resource for identifying hate groups. And whether or not you really are, as, and I get the distinction, the nuance, whether you as a cop really are racist or you're just blowing off steam or just et cetera, you're engaged in fantasy chat, it doesn't matter. Just the mere appearance is fatal to your career.
It's fatal to the
more
country. It's fatal to the
I'm
country.
Sorry?
It's fatal to the country. It doesn't matter if these particular cops ever do anything but treat every citizen the same way. It's a cancer.
I agree.
It's a cancer to America.
To them.
Yeah.
I stress to them all the time. I said, it doesn't matter. You have one post that goes, we find that one post, you're done as a cop, period. End of story. It's a mere appearance. And that's why district attorneys and the law has made it very clear. If you're one of these types of officers and it's discovered you've posted anything resembling the type of comments that you and I have been talking about it, you are banned from testifying the rest of your career. You're done. You're useless as a cop. What attorney, what prosecutor is going to put a cop on the stand who's going to get crucified by the defense?
So are you saying OJ was innocent? No, I'm kidding.
I'm sorry?
I'm kidding. No. No. Well, it's, the thing is about the OJ trial is that we in non-Black America could not understand when we saw Black America cheering when OJ got off. It was so foreign to us. But now I realize, not that OJ was innocent, but that we in non-Black America could not understand their experience of the police and what their experience of the police was worse than we could have were ready to believe. It was fantastic.
You know why OJ was found not guilty?
Because they hated the cops. Why?
Yeah. And it's because you had Mark Furman testify. Remember that? What did he testify to?
He used the N-word. He lied about it.
I've never used the N-word.
Yeah. F. Lee Bailey.
And then they brought in a radio announcer, I believe it was a radio announcer, who had taped an interview with him years before, And he's clearly on tape using the N-word.
He was using it in like a, to be fair to Mark Furman, he was using it playing a character, I think, like a narrative of a racist cop. But it was that he lied about it. It was the fact that the cops, one of the cops took the evidence home with him one night, whatever it is. And this was all seen through the prism of people who I think with justification did not trust a fucking thing, excuse me, that any cop would say. And I didn't understand that at the time I was watching the trial. On the other hand, not to let them off the hook, it's obvious and was always obvious he was guilty. So I can't excuse the jury for that kind of nullification, but
that is something I teach. I said, you know what? If you're sitting in the jury box and they hear you using that word, that they forget about everything else. It doesn't matter. It's just obscure the merits of the case. That's all they hear.
Well, right, but you would hope, and then we'll get off OJ. You would hope that that jurors would understand that, okay, this cop is racist, so I will now discount any part of this case that I have to take his word for anything. However, there's two innocent people dead here, and I have plenty of evidence that is, you know, enough to know. And I happen to remember all the evidence. We'd be fun to do a whole nother, but let's get off OJ. So now, funny that we're going to now talk about the Chauvin case. Now, the Chauvin case has always bothered me, not always. At first, when I saw it, I reacted like everybody else. I thought I was seeing basically an execution. That's what it looked like. But then as the information began to drip out, as I saw the video where the cops had he was in the back of the car, he was complaining he couldn't breathe. They said, how about this? We'll open the window that he wanted to get out. He says, okay, lay on the ground. They didn't rough him up. Then I saw that he was, and at that time he's saying, I can't breathe, before they were touching him. And then when I saw the training manuals, which showed up, chokeholds as non-lethal, and showed, had a picture of a guy with his, a cop with his knee on between the shoulder blades or the bottom of the neck, you know, pretty almost indistinguishable from the Chauvin thing. And then I began to hear about how they were taught about to be wary of excited delirium. And I heard that they were taught that if you're breathing, if you're speaking, you're breathing. And there's more. This is without getting into the elements of the fair trial. I began to have this horrible feeling that this cop was a victim of the culture that he was trained in. And then right after Floyd died, Minnesota began to change some of its regulations. They removed some parts of the manual. They changed the training about excited delirium, almost telegraphing inadvertently that we should take these things out because we kind of do understand that this was part of the reason Chauvin did all this. And I came away with this feeling that the state was the villain here, that if only the state had told him, never do that and never use a chokehold and don't worry about excited delirium. And, you know, if they told him all the things that we wished he had done, if they had simply told him to do those things rather than if they told him just because somebody's talking, don't assume they can breathe. Somebody can suffocate. Somebody can run out of oxygen even though they're talking. Like, just then none of the things he did he would have done, because if you hear the recordings, he's actually referring to his training as he's explaining why he's doing what he's doing. And I have this very uneasy feeling that this man, maybe there's some crime there, does not have the heart of a murderer. But what's your feeling? You probably know the case backwards and forwards.
No, I actually don't. I only have what I think the rest of us have. I was asked to review the policy, the one you're referring to, for my viewpoints on it for your colleagues. But I agree. When I looked at the policy and compared it to the actions of Officer Chauvin, it appeared to me that he followed training and the policy. And you know, when you look at an officer's mannerisms or any subject's mannerisms, that tells you a lot. And in this case, you know, as I told the your colleagues, I said, does this look like someone who has a guilty conscience? It's broad daylight. The whole, you know, you've got all these pedestrians. They're cell phoning him video wise. And, you know, this is something that happens hundreds of times across the United States.
Yeah.
You know, there was no intent to murder or much less even kill or injure Mr. Floyd. Unfortunately, it resulted in that unfortunate result. But I agree. My viewpoint was that this was not a malice-based killing. If anything, it was an accident.
So you don't
I see that in many compression asphyxia, what we call dog pile incidents, across the United States. I'm investigating a couple of those right now as we speak.
So you don't see that as a Noam mentioned that there might have been some lesser crime committed by Chauvin. You don't even see any crime. Or maybe some negligent homicide.
It could be negligence. But again, based on, you know, when I read the manual, the policy manual on these types of holds, restraint, I looked at it and said, well, where does it say that you cannot apply the type of force restraint that Officer Chauvin applied? Now, did he apply it in an unreasonable manner? You know, of course, we know how the juries felt about that. Mm-hmm. But again, did it rise to the level of, murder? I don't think so. I have a situation very similar to that right now that I'm investigating. And, the officer, he didn't mean to kill. You've got to look into, does this officer have a bad heart? Did he have malice in his heart, in his mind, when he committed this act? Or was it based on his reasonable perception, or was it based on his training and experience, as Noam was saying? And, California also reacted accordingly. When I say California, the legislature banned the use of a carotid restraint. After Mr. Floyd's death. Mm-hmm. But there's a misconception about whether that the carotid restraint really is prohibited, and that's another story altogether.
Well, to make matters more complicated with the Floyd case, the autopsy didn't even find asphyxiation. There were conflicting and mutually exclusive theories of causation. There was enough fentanyl in him apparently to have killed a certain percentage of people. Not everybody, wasn't like a no-brainer dosage, but he certainly could have died from the fentanyl. There's so much to the case, but the most significant kind of, this is a non-legal, but just idea of justice, is that the cop was filled with inaccurate information that had come down to him through the municipality, through his training manual, through the verbalizations of other police, through the way other policemen behaved, the culture of the force. The guy who was ready to roll down the window, and rather than just shove the guy in the back of the car, and there was no reason they had to let him out of the back of the car, and then let him lay down and call EMS. Of course, EMS takes a wrong turn or something and gets there in 9 or 11 minutes as opposed to the 2 minutes, which would have been there in time. There's so many weird things here, but I have likened it to, and I did research at the time, there are outrageous cases of medical malpractice where doctors actually dismiss the warnings of nurses and so you're telling them to make a mistake, or the dosage is wrong, or you're getting it backwards, and that lead to the death of patients.
Of course, you saw the verdict.
Yeah, and almost never, almost never are these doctors charged with homicide. They are sued, they lose their licenses, they pay through the nose, whatever it is. But somehow, when somebody makes these terrible mistakes in the profession where they're trying to do good with cops, in the profession where they're risking their lives, in the profession where they're forced into these split-second decisions, and a certain number of them we know statistically will make these decisions wrong, there's just something not satisfying, not fair about putting these people in jail, as opposed to the earlier case we talked about where these cops just murdered somebody. Like, we see it. They're taking turns kicking the shit out of him until finally somebody develops the lethal blow. There's nothing to be said there, right? And I feel like Chauvin, it was not that case. My friend Coleman Hughes is, I think, preparing a rather long article for the Free Press, which is going to be a rebuttal to Rodney Balco, who's a rebuttal to the article that Coleman had already written. So there'll be much more about this, and maybe you'll want to come back to comment on it. We're just about out of time. Anything else you want to comment about that?
I just had one question.
Go ahead, Dan. Go ahead.
I'd want just to get back to the initial video we saw of the naked man that was shot by the cops. Is there no technological solution to this? Aren't there like net guns or something? Or it would seem almost impossible that there's not some technological solution to a case like that, where a guy's running around with a small blade, you know.
Yeah. You know, I'm glad you asked that. And it's a good question. And I believe me, I understand the sentiment, but the plain answer is no. There are other devices out there, but not every department or officer is equipped with it. Like we have what's known as RAPS, you know, where you can, it's kind of a bolo device. You may have seen it, you know, on YouTube or on news, where basically you shoot this, you know, literally a bolo, and it wraps around the individual's torso or legs, and supposed to immobilize the individual. Or there's, like I said, tasers. There's 40 millimeter launchers, heavy foam bullets, you name it. But many of those typically, you know, may not be effective. I'm not being facetious here. I've said this numerous times. The only device that will put an end to police shootings and use of force, it'll come sooner or later, is a Star Trek phaser.
Yeah.
But we're not there yet.
All right. Well, look, sir.
Because again, what we're left with, keep in mind, all we have, I say we as cops, all we have are the tools on our belt, a taser, a baton, pepper spray, our handgun, and sheer brutal strength. Unfortunately, that is force.
Perry wants to say.
And it's hard force. Yeah. And it's going to result in injuries or death. It's just unfortunately part of, you know.
Perry wants to say something.
I just have a quick question. Hi, how are you?
Hi.
We've been talking online. So you know how, like, in the 70s, when they figured out that serial killers were a real thing in the FBI, and they created a behavioral science unit, which before that was did not exist, and they have things like Major Case or SVU, why wouldn't it be the case that the police departments across America would put together a mental health department that were specifically designed, trained, the officers would of course be educated and trained to deal with situations that are exactly like the one you've been describing, and of course Noam's friend situation?
No, good question. I can speak primarily for California and many other departments that follow the response protocol. Officers from day one in the academy are trained. They are trained in behavioral health issues. There are departments that do have the resources to partner up with social services, trained clinical technicians. Those individuals that, you know, with social services that are much more professional, professionally trained in these areas, and they ride together. What I always try to point out, though, is that, number one, it's a luxury that 99% of departments can't afford to begin with. Number two, those types of response units are not designed and are not intended to respond to a situation like one who is armed, one who is just hell-bent on either killing someone, killing himself, or others who interfere. We are not going to put a civilian clinician in harm's way for obvious reasons. Those types of units, response units, are really designed to address non-violent or semi-compliant individuals in situations. But you can imagine, we're not going to have a civilian go up to someone with a knife and start talking to them. That it's just not going to happen. So again, yes.
Sir, we're out of time because we have to do another show right after you. But I wanted to say that I'm very impressed by you, because as opposed to almost everybody else, you don't seem to have a dog in this fight. You seem to be ready to call the police out when the police deserve it, and you seem to be ready to defend the police when the police deserve to be defended, and that's not a usual type of person. So I don't know you that well. Maybe I'll find out that's you. Are you crazy, this guy? But from the little interaction I have with you, that's the vibe I get, and I find that very, very impressive. So as there unfortunately will certainly be future nationally interesting events that concern the police, I would love it if you could be someone we could come back to discuss these things in the future.
Be more than glad to. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Ed Obayashi signing off. Thank you, Ed.
Thank you.
Podcast@comedyseller.com. Podcast@comedyseller.com. Okay.
Noam, you said something very far reaching. You're saying that Chauvin is a sacrificial lamb and almost a hero, a tragic hero.
Not a hero.
Well, insofar,
you can log off. You're good.
Oh yeah, yeah. We're just happy. We're just doing post chat.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, in a sense that.
Wait, are we still on air? Are we still recording?
We're still recording.
Okay, yeah, great. Yeah. Okay.
In the sense that he basically died for the sins of the country.
Like Jesus?
Well, you know, for our racial sins, he was sacrificed. And in that sense, what you seem to be saying is, well, I don't know, hero may be too strong a word, but...
Hero was not what you're describing, but you're saying that he was sacrificed?
Sacrificed.
There is some evidence to that, because there's much more to that case in terms of the fact that there was a juror who had a T-shirt saying, "Get your knee off my neck," or "Get your knee off our necks." Could you, like, before the trial, this is what the guy was wearing, a T-shirt, pretty much indicating what his take was on the guilt of the defendant. That's not the way it's supposed to be. That doesn't make him innocent, but it certainly doesn't. It certainly would seem to make the trial unfair. And there were other things like that. They didn't ask for change of venue. They didn't sequester the jury. None of the things that we've seen on similarly, well, there's never been a bigger case, right? But none of the things we've seen in smaller cases that got attention, many things were done. Okay, we have to go. Okay. See you later, everybody. Good night.